In third grade, after lunch, my teacher, Mrs. Silvernail, asked everyone to take out their math books. Now, I hate math, but it's not up to me, so I do what I'm told. But Mrs. Silvernail says, "Not you, Glenn. You come with me for a moment." Uh-oh. In the hall, she bends down. "Now, Glenn, do you understand why the other kids tease you?" I'm thinking, yeah. They laugh at my answers. My parents make me wear these dress socks with tennis shoes. I bring peanut butter and cucumber sandwiches in my lunchbox. Danny makes everyone sing about my big lips. Mrs. Silvernail says, "They make fun of you because of your lisp." Huh? "But not to worry, because from now on, every day during math, you're going to go to something called speech therapy." And she takes me to another lady that makes me say, "Susie sells seashells by the seashore." Again and again. "Susie sells seashells by the seashore." Every day, when the other kids are doing fractions and long division, sometimes I say, "Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers." But at the end of the year, Miss Silvernail says, "I should be proud because I don't have a lisp anymore." 3 decades later, when as a grown man, I go to meet a big radio professional, and I tell him I want to start a show called Snap Judgment. And he kind of shakes his head and says, "Seems like a pipe dream, but you've come a long way for someone with a speech impediment." Yeah, I'm shaking because I thought I didn't have that anymore. Miss Silvernail lied to me. But what really leaves me upset is that after all those years, I can't do math. Then Snap Judgment from WNYC, "Can't Hold Me Down." Amazing stories from real people who made a way out of no way. My name is Glenn Washington. 33 divided by 14 is, I don't know. I was in speech class. Because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Now, for our first story, we're going to 1970s West Texas, where the good meets the bad and the ugly. Snap Judgment.
I got tired of running up and down the highway 115 mile an hour all day long and writing tickets.
After 9 years on highway patrol, Bob Faber needed something more exciting. So he joined the Texas Rangers. Texas Rangers are like the fixers. They help local police solve their toughest cases, and Bob solved hundreds. There was the preacher who fell in love with a married woman and then shot her husband. There was the necrophiliac funeral worker and the cattle poachers at the King Ranch. But of all of them, one case sticks out. It starts in Brady, a small town in the dusty middle of Texas.
Elton David Myers. I never heard of that hombre. In 1970, policeman in Brady PD called and told me, said, "Well, that old kid that used to live here, they thought that he is over here at his aunt's house in Brady."
The old kid was Elton David Myers, and he had just escaped from jail.
We drove by the house and parked. We saw him. He was sitting in the living room. The blind is up. When we walked back up there to the yard, he was up and he was nervous. He was looking around, just pacing the floor. I guess he had heard a stop up there. So I started down the north side of the house. As he had walked past a window in the house, I just stayed abreast of him outside. I saw him because it's dark. The house was illuminated. He was on a mission, and that mission was get to that back door and get out of there. And we just went side by side the whole length of that shotgun house. He went out the back door and run out in the dark. I just bulldogged him and we went to the ground.
Elton David Myers had run right into Bob's arms. Bob handcuffed him and drove him down to the local jail.
He was wiry and he was about 5'10", on the best day, 160 pounds. But he was tough.
Just a short while later, Bob noticed a string of new burglaries. No one had told him, but David had broken out of jail again. He was stealing cars all over Texas and New Mexico, until he was arrested for robbery and locked up, this time in a maximum security prison. But even that couldn't hold him. David escaped again, and this one was big. When Bob went to the prison, he learned that David had grabbed three of the guards' keys and from inside his cell made copies using a slice of stale bread.
David managed to get that key just for a moment while the sheriff was distracted, and he laid it down on that bread and folded that bread over and mashed it on that bread, put the key back in the cell door. Well, he had his pattern right there. Well, he saved his toothbrush handles, his plastic spoons and forks and stuff. And then he always wanted Brute aftershave lotion, but Brute got a lot of alcohol in it. He'd break all that plastic up and then and use that Brute aftershave lotion for fuel, and it would melt that. Then he poured that melted plastic into the bread where the impression of the key was. I still have that key. It worked like a charm.
That was probably the moment when Bob realized Elton David Myers wasn't an ordinary criminal. He was actually a little impressed with David's smarts and tenacity.
And that rascal, he was a locksmith and a magician. One store he broke into, the safe wasn't even locked. Yet when we got there, it had been completely disassembled. And I asked him later, I said, "What the devil did you tear that man's safe up for?" He said, "I had never seen that type of safe before. So I took it apart so if I ever ran across another one, I would know how it worked." I said, "Nothing like on-the-job training." He didn't have to take pencil, paper, and write notes. He just retained it in his head.
No prison or jail in Texas could hold David Myers. One morning with David and his new girlfriend on the lam again, Bob got a call from a sheriff about a car David had stolen. The sheriff was calling from Montana.
I said, "He's probably that burglar in your grocery store right now. He better get you some help because he's got a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun and a 45 automatic pistol. And you're probably going to have a little gunplay when you come out." About 2 hours later, he called me. He said, "Boy, you was right on all counts."
The cops had caught David's girlfriend, but he'd gotten away.
"So if you got any other ideas?" I said, "Yeah, I sure do." I said, "The best thing you do is get you an armed guard around the clock there in the jail, because he's going to come in at gunpoint and try to get her out of there, or he's going to kidnap somebody and make a trade with you." And I told him, I said, "I'll be up there just as soon as I can get there."
So Bob hopped into his patrol car and drove the 24 hours to Montana. Once he got there, the authorities had captured David in a hail of gunfire.
Went by the hospital, and old David was laying there flat on his back. He had a handcuff on each wrist, leg iron on one leg. It went through the footboard. He saw me, he kind of grinned. He said, "Oh, I'm glad to see you." He said, "I need to scratch my nose, and I can't even move." And I told him, "I said, you better not move." I said, "That deputy will blow you plumb out of that bed if you start moving." So anyway, we visited there a few minutes, and I said, "David, we're heading to Texas tomorrow. If you can walk, you can go with us. If you can't walk, you're just going to stay right here." He wiggled his toes a little bit, and he said, "You know, I'm beginning to get a little feeling already." And there wasn't nothing wrong with him. He just faking all that injury and everything. And I knew it.
Waiting for his chance.
Yeah, right. Waiting for his chance.
Bob had to get a Montana judge's written permission to extradite David back to Texas.
Coming back from Montana, when he started to talk about what he had in mind and how he was going to rescue his girl from us, and he would probably kidnap one of my children, and then hey, it had me over a barrel. That's when I just slammed on the brakes, slid to a halt. And I told him, I said, up to now, it's always just between the law and the outlaw. But I said, if you ever mention my family again, I'll kill you where you sit. And I guess he understood that, because I never had any more conversation like that.
Over the next several years, with Bob close on his heels, David would steal dozens of cars, rob countless grocery stores, and break into safes all over Texas.
I hauled him back and forth to penitentiary so many times I lost track of it.
In jail, David would shut down and not talk to anyone, so the police would always have to call Bob in. The two ended up spending so much time together that this relationship became something beyond just cops and robbers.
We'd just visit. We'd talk about his grandma and his grandpa, who I knew real well, and his mother abandoned him when he was a baby, and his daddy gave him to his grandma and grandpa. They were good people, but they were old people, and they were hard people. I mean, I don't imagine, and there was a time in his life that anyone, other than maybe in a heat of passion, some girl, no one ever embraced him and told him they loved him. I don't think he probably never had that said to him. And I sure hell wasn't going to tell him I loved him, but that's why it looked like he was looking for a friend. If I could be his friend, I'd be his friend. And if it took a little bragging on him, what the heck? I learned right quick. I said, David, you've got a talent that most folks don't have. Unfortunately, that talent is your trademark, but you've got it. That's all I can say is you're good. Well, he sat there and he started grinning just a little bit. And I'd brag on him a little bit more. And next thing he knew, he's telling me every cotton-picking thing that I wanted to know about the job. And he just couldn't resist.
But David never made things easy on Bob. One day, Bob got a call from the Brady sheriff.
And he was crying. All I could understand him say, he said, they're gone. And they didn't need to say anything else. I knew what he meant.
David had made another key and escaped from the Brady jail. This time, he was on the run with a girlfriend and his cousin. The police spotted their car near the Llano River, but the trio had fled on foot into the brush. So Bob started a manhunt on horseback. One day became two, 2 days became three, and when they came up with nothing, the prison warden loaned them dogs.
The grass birds were so darn bad, some of the dogs did quit running.
He's talking about spiky grass stickers. They were stabbing the dog's feet. So the warden hired a bootmaker.
He had 20 dogs, and he had to make 80 shoes.
What did the dogs look like?
Well, I'll tell you, that was the funniest sight. Some of those dogs was just as proud as punch of their footwear. And others was just like they're walking and tapping. They're just stepping real high.
Charging after the dogs on horseback in the pitch black, hoping not to get brained by a tree branch, this was the most brutal, physically demanding hunt for David that Bob had ever been involved in.
I got up Monday morning. I did not lay back down until Friday night.
Was there a point when you thought, I'm not having fun with this guy anymore?
Yeah, I was very concerned about my family, and I knew he knew where I lived. He knew every house in town, you know. I was always concerned that he might try to double back and go by the house or something. He kept the doors locked real good and barred, but that just keeps your friends out. I was concerned about it, but I just make you want to work that much harder to go ahead and catch him and get him put away.
After 5 days, Bob finally caught sight of the convicts. They were captured, David got a life sentence, and was labeled a habitual criminal by the state of Texas. For the trial, Bob was tasked with hauling David back and forth from Brady to the Ellis unit at Huntsville, probably the most secure prison in Texas.
I had leg irons on him, had belly chain on him, had one handcuffed to one hip, the other hand was handcuffed to the other hip. First red light, I stopped that in Huntsville. Back door open, he jumped out and ran off. Leg irons laying in the floor, his hands out of the handcuffs. My first thought was, what in the devil? How did this happen? And I jumped out and I left my car sitting right in the middle of that red light intersection with the doors open. And I was running, he was running down the center stop. I was running after him. And but it wasn't any way you get a shot at him because it was 2 minutes of traffic. And ran him about a block, and then he turned and went into a construction site. And the bulldozer had been raining, the bulldozer had been working, it just soupy mud. And the mud was so deep that it got over the tops of my boots and got down in my boots. And ran up there, and I nearly fell in this creek. It was dark as night. And I stopped just in time, and I could hear him splashing around in there a little bit. And then I saw an outline of him, a little bit of his image in there. And boy, and I was out of wind. I was running out of deep mud, and I took as steady aim as I could, and I shot. I missed, and I shot again, and I missed. Took a deep breath, and I shot again, and there's a good resounding thud that you get when you shoot a deer. And he just squalled out and fell face down in that creek. I thought, well, oh boy, we've been through a lot. This is where it ends right here. I just waited for him to sink. A little bit, he rolled over and was squalling and crying. Oh, God, Bob, don't, I'm dying. Don't shoot me again, I'm dying. I said, well, get out of that damn creek and come back up here. He walked back up there, crawled out of the water. That darn bullet had gone right through the panel of his coat and hadn't even touched his flesh or nothing. I said, well, you son of a gun, you're not even bleeding. You're not even shot. He started gagging, and looked in his mouth. He had a key on his end of his tongue. He'd been trying to swat it. They made the key out of a ballpoint pen liner.
When you had to shoot at him, did you hesitate or anything? Was there any regret or when you thought you'd killed him?
Not really. You don't want to kill anybody, first of all. But the thing of it is, you just do what you have to do.
David got another long sentence, and now the old kid was done for good. A decade went by with David securely in prison. And then one day, Bob, who was now a lieutenant near retirement, noticed some eerily familiar burglaries. Safes were being cracked all over West Texas.
I told everybody, I said, that just sounds to me like that's old David Byers' work. But he's in the pen. I said, well, let's just check and see. Well, hell, he'd been on the ground for a year. He'd paroled out. He'd got a job out there at El Paso at a bootmaker making boots.
2 decades after Bob first tackled him, David was back in the small Texas jails where his career as a burglar had begun. As usual, the jailers couldn't get a word out of David. So Bob offered to drive down and talk to him. And after chatting for a while, David turned to Bob.
He said, I'm not going to escape out of this jail, but I want to show you how I can. I've already found a flaw where I get it.
David was referring to a flaw in the design of the jail. So Bob told the officers, but all he got was a curt reply.
Nice, it's a brand new jail. Said, it's escape proof. He's not going anywhere. Okay. A few days later, he's gone. Took two buddies with him.
David and his new buddies stole four cars. They robbed grocery stores for cash and food, committing 27 burglaries in total, so many they had to leave the state. Weeks later, Bob got a call about David. But this call was different. David and his buddies had gotten into an altercation over a young woman, and one of them pulled a gun on David.
They put two bullets in the back of his head and killed him.
The two men were caught in Illinois, and the shooter left a message for Bob.
Tell old Bob he can retire now, said I've killed David for him, or something along those lines. I buried David there in the cowboy cemetery.
You kept track of him, as you say, for 18 years.
Yeah.
What went through your mind when we knew he was dead?
Well, I guess it was a little sad. It was a relief.
Do you think he considered you a friend?
I think he did. Yeah. Yeah. And he told me, he said, I'll tell you this, you and I would have made one hell of a team. I said, what are you talking about? He said, it's not a job that I can't pull and not anything that I can't do. But every time I look up, there you are right on my ass. I said, I guess that's sort of a left-handed compliment. I don't know.
Big, big thanks to our Texas Ranger, Bob Favor, for sharing his story up to Snap. The original sound design for that piece was by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Luke Quinton. You can check out more of Luke's work at our website, snapjudgment.org. Now, when Snap returns, the absolutely worst way to have a long-distance conversation and what to do when everything collapses. When the Can't Hold Me Down episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Can't Hold Me Down episode. Now, everyone wants to move up in life, a better job, a better house, but what are you willing to pay? Snap Judgment's Davey Kim has a story.
Tabinda grew up in a big family. She loved that she had a lot of sisters, three older and two younger, her retired parents. Oh, and then there was her brother Hamad. He was 14 and the youngest.
I belonged to a very, very mediocre family. We were from lower middle class. My father was a driver. We children, we have very few luxuries in our life. Actually, luxury was a very unique word for us. Only the boys are given good food, good clothing, good schooling.
In Pakistani society, often the boys were groomed to be the breadwinners of the family. And since Hamad got all the good stuff, Tabinda needed to earn a little pocket money. So when she was 22, she took a 45-minute commute from her hometown in Muzaffarabad to teach at a tiny two-story school in the rural mountain village of Karka. She wanted the young boys and girls in her class to basically dream big.
I just want to make them feel that they should have a goal in life. They can be like anyone in the city. They can earn money, they can feel better. Because, you know, in our society, people used to say that one day we will become a big man, like they want to be the bada aadmi. And then I was like, anyone from you, even if your father is just a laborer, if you are getting education, you can be the bada aadmi.
But deep down inside, Tabinda, she really didn't believe what she preached.
I feel like I'm trapped in a wrong society. I was never, like, I was not belong to this. I had no options. They think the good women just take care of the house. In the end, your only option is, actually, you can say the end of the career is the marriage. Inside myself, I was saying, no, I can't do that. I cannot marry to just someone in the world. I just accepted that this is the reality of my life.
Tobinda knew the plan. Soon, her dad would marry her off, and that was that. So Tobinda savored each and every day she got to teach. It meant freedom, at least for now.
That day, it was the holy month of Ramadan here, a very normal day for everyone. I was checking the children's uniform, cleaning, nails and all those things. And suddenly, I heard a blast. Everything was started shaking. I was going right and left. I could not even stand properly. Suddenly, I had a feeling that, oh my God, the building is going to collapse. I was trying to go towards the door, but the children who were standing near me, they were screaming, "Teacher, help, help us, teacher, what's happening?" They grabbed me. It was so scary. I was trying to drag the children towards the door, and then suddenly the building was collapsed on us. All the rubble was on me and on the children. First floor's roof on the ground. The only sentence which came in my mind that my story is over. That's it. Now I have to wait for the death. But it's like that someone told inside me that, get up, please get up. And I took my head up and I was able to see the sky. My feet, my legs were badly injured. And then I saw the children inside the rubble and some were half in, half out. I was shouting, please, please, someone, please save my children. But no one was coming. I was like, we couldn't see anything because it was so much dust. But after an hour, when the dust settled, we saw other side of the river has a big landslide and the village on that mountain was totally destroyed. Then we all realized that this is something big. I remember a 7-year-old girl. She came to me and she was crying badly and she said, "Teacher, my sister is inside the school." I could not tell her not to cry. I was just speechless. And after a few minutes, I saw her sister was like running behind the school. 7 or 8-year-old girl. When she came to me and she just gave me my purse and said, "Here is your purse." Oh my God, I get angry to her that why did you risk your life only for my purse? When we were running towards the door, she was going back to the chair to get my purse. She said, "Teacher, you might have something important in it." By the 12 o'clock, a man who was going to Muzaffarabad, he came back. Everyone rushed to him that what happened? Where is the government? Where is the army? He just held his head. He sat down on the ground. He was also screaming, crying. He said, "There is no one in Muzaffarabad." At that time, I realized that, oh my God, my family also suffered from it.
At first, the people in the village thought that a bomb had hit the area, but they found out it was a 7.6 magnitude earthquake. Almost 80,000 people would die, and another 4 million would be left homeless in the aftermath.
I don't know how long I cried. I was just praying to God, save them. All of them are not alive. Please save some of them.
Tobinda had to wait 5 days until her feet were well enough to limp back home. Since the main roads were closed because of mud and landslides, the journey took 9 hours of skirting along a mountain edge. When she finally arrived in her hometown, Muzaffarabad, she expected to see a city in chaos and mourning, but
it was so quiet and silent. I can see the houses down and the clothes are coming out of the cupboards. Everything was like open. Everything was collapsed. I saw the blood on the roads and it tells the story what happened here. I reached to a friend's house and her parents told me that my family is safe, they are well, And I had a telephone conversation with my sister. She told me that everyone is safe. And I was so happy that in a such big disaster, God saved my family. I was so, you know, calm inside me. So I wanted to know all my friends are safe, their families are safe. I called one of my friends. She said, everyone is okay, but my eldest brother has died. When she told me that her brother has died, and the next moment, the family, they told me, they thought that I knew about my brother. Then they told, okay, no one else, only your brother has died. And I was like, shocked, what?
Tabinda's friend on the phone had accidentally revealed that Tabinda did in fact lose someone in her family. It was supposed to be a secret.
When I entered my street, I saw my father was standing there. And when I get to him and he hold me and he said, don't cry. You only lost your brother. There are so many people who lost the whole family. So be strong. And I could not stop crying. We used to think that brothers, even they are younger than us, one day when they will grow up, we can hide behind them. They can be our shield. That day, that earthquake, that disaster just took our shield from us.
With their house demolished, they relocated to a relief camp, expecting to come together. Instead,
one of my married elder sister, she was so hurt. She told me that something happened in her family. Someone blamed her, dragged her in the argument. She said, keep me away from that. And then her sister-in-law, she told her she cannot speak because she don't have any brother. Now you have to obey us in every kind of situation. It makes me so, you know, in the first moment I was so hurt. If they even abuses her, she has to be quiet. And then I realized why. Why a sister cannot be the shield of the family? At that time, in my heart, in my mind, I decided that, okay, I'll be the son of my parents. I'll be the brother of my sisters.
Against her dad's wishes, Tabinda got a job as a social worker, traveling to different relief camps. Now, you may think this is good, since she can now provide for her family. Tabinda said that women social workers were considered damaged goods because they went out and talked to men as a part of their work.
My father, he said, okay, go out, but keep in mind that you have to take care of your dignity, my respect. If I heard anything wrong, I'll punish you in a very bad way. I'll, you know, burn you alive, set in fire. He just threatened me. But still, I just focused on the permission that I'm allowed to do something. It always makes me sad whenever I felt that my father is not happy that a girl is supporting the family. I often thought that it would have been better if God had taken me or one of my sisters rather than my little brother. In our society, usually girls don't move alone. So first, when I was going out for job, I was going very far, 8 to 10 hours in the bus at that day. And I was the only girl in the bus. They said, why are you going there? Inside me, I was actually literally shaking. I told them the reason. And I was crying in the bus. And they start saying that, you are our sister, don't worry. We will help you to get to home and all that. I felt that, okay, it wasn't a big deal. Nobody, you know, hurt me. Then I decided, that's fine. It's okay if I'm traveling alone.
Through her job, Tabinda provided for her family. But her dad, he didn't even talk to her for years.
This is a very sensitive question. He never, initially he never expressed his feeling to me. But yes, 3 years ago, I remember my mother told me, he asked my mother to cook something special When she asked why, and he said, "My son is coming." That was the first time when I realized that now my father is considering me a son, finally.
Even as Thabinda went town to town for work, there was one place she couldn't bring herself to visit.
The people of Karka and those children. I never thought to go back. I was just trying to escape from my fear, my pain. But I don't know why, but it came in my mind suddenly that on the 10th anniversary, I decided to go back again. I expected the Karka, same destroyed small village. But when I reached that village, it has a good market. Shops were big and, you know, local buses were moving around. It was like a town now. When I reached the building where the school was, I could feel the assembly, the school and the building. I knocked the door, a woman came out and she said, "Who is that?" I said, "You might don't remember me, but I was here at the time of earthquake." And suddenly she just, "Are you Thabinda?" I said, "Yes, I'm Thabinda." And she was so happy to see me. And we talked about that day, who else died, how they survived. And then suddenly I asked them, that, "Do you remember there was a girl who bring my purse back? Do you know her?" She said, "Yes, she was my daughter." And I was so surprised and I said, "Please call her, I want to meet her." I was just expecting an average reaction from her. But when she came down, she hugged me and then she was holding my hands for, you know, 15 to 20 minutes. She said, "It's a day of celebration for me that I got you back. Every day I was thinking you might come one day." I was so surprised, and her mother and the other ladies were all laughing. Whenever I saw my students, I just felt that I'm a teacher again. I asked, "Are you studying?" And she said, "No, I left the school." And then I asked her that, "At least if you are not getting married, you should study." She said, "Now you said to me, it's an order for me. I'll start my education again."
After saying goodbye, Thabinda was about to head back home when she ran into a woman named Sajida Tanvir.
Her husband left home the day of earthquake for the office, but she never found his body. Sajida had a 1-year-old daughter and she was pregnant at that time with the second kid. She went to his husband's office and said, "My husband is missing. Can I do the job instead of him?" She was given a much lesser paid job. She struggled, but after 10 years, she was able to, you know, make her own house. She was giving her children all the facilities of life. She was so confident. She was crying, but her voice was not even shaking. I asked her that, "Have you ever think of getting married again?" She said, "I know it's not a bad thing, but my focus are my children. I don't want to split my love and my care." I realized at that time that, oh my God, that earthquake, that disaster not only changed my life, but it also changed so many women's life.
Thabinda, do you ever wonder what it would be like if Hamad was still around? Like, would things be different?
If I didn't lose him?
Yeah.
I think of this thing every day. I felt that there would be someone who was there to share my burden. If Hamad was still alive, my parents would feel more safe and happy. And maybe I was another Thabinda who is more shy. Mm. She cannot make decisions. And she has a very, you know, ordinary life.
Well, then, would you consider the earthquake, the disaster, was that a good thing for you?
That disaster, that earthquake was never a good thing for me. But yes, after that, it gave me courage. I never knew about myself. I would never be able to know how much I'm capable for. That earthquake actually made me realize that there is something strong inside me. But honestly speaking, if someone give me the deal that you want this career, this, you know, name, or you want your brother back, I would go for my brother again.
Big thanks to Binda for sharing her incredible story with The Snap. And special thanks as well to the fine folks at the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast for their help on this piece. Check them out for amazing stuff. And for more into Binda's life, we're going to have a link to her story on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original sound design and even the instrumentals for this piece were by Davey Kim. It was produced by Davey Triple Threat Kim. Now, imagine an old-fashioned cell phone. Even older than that. Even older than that. That's what we got. When the Can't Hold Me Down episode continues, stay tuned. WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Can't Hold Me Down episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, people do things despite the best efforts of other people not to have them done. And next up, a very special message floated in a bottle. Mimi Faye and Brian Waldron bring us their story.
We used to go visit my friend in Patchogue, Long Island. And her daughters are approximately the same age. And they would go off in a day. And apparently they threw many bottles, but this is the only bottle that came back.
Hurricane Sandy crashing on shore. Winds now at 90 miles per hour.
We're essentially inside the storm, Diane. It is just to our south. We're easily getting
into the storm. This storm is so big, so vast, 60 million Americans will feel its power.
Bottles, cans, garbage, wood, car pods, anything that you can think of was washed up. I mean, it probably was like 2 feet high worth of debris. And I heard one of the FEMA workers say, oh, I found this bottle, it's got a note in it. I didn't see the phone number until we opened up took the letter out of the bottle and we saw the number. It was a 212 number, Manhattan.
It was in December 2012. On my phone, I always have my daughter's picture at age 18. And that day, I had changed it to 10 because she has this big smile and she's walking on the street. So when I came home, there was a message on my machine.
I told Mimi when I left a message with her that, you know, who I am and, you know, who I work for, and we found the ginger ale bottle. I read the note to her on the phone, and it said Bill and Ted's Great Adventure from the 1989 movie, and it said, be excellent to yourself, dude. I didn't realize how old the movie was because I didn't see the movie from 1989. The younger guys had to tell me about the movie.
This man says, oh, we found a bottle on the beach, and it says, be excellent to yourself, dude, and it gave your phone number. And they were laughing, these two men, so they thought it was like something random.
I would say at least 3 hours later, she left a message on my phone. I called her back when I got home, and she was just very frantic on the phone. She was just, you could hardly understand her. She was crying. I didn't realize how long the bottle was in the water until Mimi told me it was in the water for at least 10 or 11 years. So when she told me, then I really like couldn't believe that the bottle didn't break.
The message is from a movie called Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure that Sidonie liked. It's actually about time travel.
Now, a motion picture so grand, so magnificent, and so vast, it spans 7,000 years.
No way! Yes, way!
In the movie, they say be excellent to each other, but she changed it to be excellent to yourself, dude.
Bill and Ted's
Excellent! Excellent!
Excellent Adventure.
Because it was the year of 2001, after the World Trade Center. And I think it was a very hard year for her, since she's born 9/11 and being of French and Persian origin. I think she had a hard time in New York explaining that, having a double citizenship and having a mother who's from Middle East doesn't make her against everything. Last year of high school, she was very unhappy here. So I took her to a boarding school in Switzerland. On April 23rd, they went on this unauthorized picnic on top of a mountain. And there were no signs that it was dangerous and you couldn't climb down and walk around because there were lots of kids walking around. And she walked down with this other boy, and they just fell.
She was telling me about the whole story, and then I was like, wow, I have a child of my own. So it hit me. Then I realized, then I came in the house, and I told my wife, and my wife kind of didn't believe it either. And then when she was sending pictures of the daughter and the movie and all that, so then I started to, you know, realize that, you know, this tragic story.
My God, I mean, it's something unbelievable. You can't imagine having a message sort of from beyond. This message came after her death, 2 years after her death. Something in your daughter's handwriting and her sense of humor, I knew it was from her.
Day or two later, she met me at the Patchogue train station. She got off the train. She was crying. She had a picture of her daughter. She brought gifts. And so we were all in the Patchogue train station in the parking lot with my bosses, with the FEMA guy. And we were just like all huddling around. And we all went down to the beach club. So I was kind of like holding her arm. You know, she was like in high heels and a dress. So I was kind of like holding on to her so she wouldn't like fall, you know, in the sand. So we walked out on the beach club and showed her the exact spot that we found it. And we were taking a couple of pictures. And that was it.
He's very nice. He keeps texting me. He came to visit with his family and gave me a picture of Sidonie with a poem that his daughter wrote.
You know, I told her when we saw her at the train station that we'd be friends, you know, forever now. And she did say to me that, you know, I feel like Sidonie wanted you to find the bottle that day. And I said it too. I said, you know, I feel that in my heart that she wanted me to make the call that day.
Thank you very much, Mimi and Brian, for sharing your story. The piece comes to us from producer Eleanor McDowell. It originally aired on the BBC program Shortcuts. It's an amazing program that showcases new short documentaries from producers across the globe. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. Now, it's about that time. If you missed even a moment of the program, I'm sorry. There is nothing I can do for you. Psych. Get the amazing storytelling podcast delivered. Snapjudgment.org. Along with all kinds of extras and such. Yes, we're on the Facebook. Yes, we are on the Twitter. Tell your mother, tell your father, send a telegram. It's all available at snapjudgment.org. Snap was produced by myself and the crew that has never, ever whacked because we stand strong. Give it up for the Uber producer who floats like gravity and never had a cavity, Mr. Mark Ristich. Papa C. Miller gets loose off of orange juice. Anna never half steps because she's not a half step assessment. Nancy Lopez will never let a statue tell her how nice she is. They call Davy Kim Dr. Pepper. Joe left his wallet in El Segundo Rosenberg. Renzo Gorio used to have a crush on Dawn from En Vogue. Eliza Smith is smooth like butter. Matt Ducat
knows how to push it along. Lee Morimoto has been a scholar since being knee-high to a duck. And Jasmine Bonita Applebaum Aguilera. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could have two tickets to the Knicks game, and your date could stiff you up, leaving you stressed out more than anyone could ever be. And then could decide to take a trip. And while everybody knows that you go to Georgia often, you get off the flight and end up in Boston, where for some strange reason you are repeatedly mistaken for Mr. Belvedere. Think about it. And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.